This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Barr McClellan. He is a lawyer from Texas. His firm was once the law firm for Lyndon Baines Johnson. Barr McClellan believes that a man named Malcolm Mack Wallace was at least one of the shooters in Dallas on November 22, 1963. He wrote about it in his book, Blood, Money, and Power. And Barr McClellan is the father of former George Bush press secretary Scott McClellan. We will talk with him. Also on the show, Michael O'Neill, fine actor from Auburn University. He's in Dallas Buyers Club, a provocative new film coming soon with Matthew McConaughey in a starring role, a role that is somewhat controversial. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is the author of Blood, Money, and Power, Barr McClellan. He is a lawyer who his firm represented Lyndon Johnson at one time. And Barr McClellan has some provocative thoughts that he expressed not only in his book, but also in a History Channel documentary about the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. We're on the eve of the 50th anniversary, and good morning to you, Barr McClellan.
Morning, Jim.
Nice to hear your distinctive voice. Where were you? where were you on November 22, 1963?
Well, I was at home finishing up law school and giving my firstborn son lunch. And I, my mother-in-law came in at the time and told me what had happened. So it was, I'm telling you, you talk about something devastating. And it's been with me ever since. I think one of the reasons why, and I bring this out in my book, is we still haven't brought justice for John Kennedy. I think it's wonderful, and we should be having the remembrances we have of him. But right now we have what a supermajority of America believes there was a conspiracy, and so does the Kennedy family. And we haven't solved that. So you really haven't resolved it. And yet the remembrances now are fully deserved, and, of course, participating them in as much as I can.
What firsthand knowledge do you have of people who might have been involved, in your estimation, in the assassination of President Kennedy?
Well, the first word I got was from a law partner who said that Clark took care of things, arranged the assassination.
Now,
and
Clark,
that was Ed Clark.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, that was Ed Clark, who was well recognized as the super boss of Texas, the secret boss of Texas, and the only man Johnson trusted. And with the law firm there, you just have access to, and you hear about things that your partners aren't going to share with anyone else. I mean, you're there, and you talk about these things. But I was also confirmed by Don Thomas, who was the fellow who took care of the box of 13 scandal back in 1948. And then Ed Clark himself, because he came to me right after Johnson left office and said, I need to get a well. And I thought, okay. And it turned out it was a payoff bonus for him for the work he did to arrange the assassination. So I had all this inside information that you almost have to have in a case like this. But you have to prove it, too, and I set out to do that by reviewing what the Warren Commission had done and focused on the fingerprints and ran the fingerprints on a fellow who had killed a couple of people I knew for sure for Johnson, and he matched. And that pretty much made the case as far as I was concerned, but we also had an eyewitness that placed this guy, Mack Wallace, on the sixth floor, and the case was really made because going into it, this evidence was not available.
Okay.
When I started. Now, but Mac, after that, you know.
Mack Wallace is an infamous Texan, and we'll talk about him, but who was the witness who saw Mr. Wallace on the sixth floor?
It was a fellow named Loy Factor, and he was enlisted by Wallace at the funeral services for Sam Rayburn, the former speaker. And he described how he was enlisted, how he was tested to see if he could shoot and if he was willing to do it. And his book, his story is told in a book on the men on the sixth floor, which has been around happened since about 1994.
Now, you're saying that there was a fingerprint match of Malcolm Mack Wallace on the sixth floor of the school book depository. Why have we not heard about this?
Well, first of all, the Warren Commission, when it was closing up, realized it hadn't identified a number of fingerprints, so it ordered its staff to do a quick job. And they came back and said, oh, nothing to worry about. We found them all. Well, a lot of things the Warren Commission said were not true. But from my standpoint, it was to see if how good a job Warren had done. And on the fingerprints, we took them to a latent print examiner who had excellent credentials. I mean, he'd worked for Kodak on print examinations. He'd set up the print system in the Philippines at the end of World War II. I mean, the guy was around. We asked him blind to see if he could match it to all the prints that were recovered from the sniper's nest on the sixth floor. And after a couple of weeks, he said, yeah, I've got a match. And I said, now, Nathan, this is a heavy-duty case. Now, you don't know what it is yet, but you sure you want to go ahead with this? And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, well, okay, it's the Kennedy assassination. You still want to do it? And he said, oh, yeah, I mean, the match is there. So anyway, once we had the match, we moved forward. The Assassination Records Review Board was finishing up its work at the time, so they couldn't take it. But we took it to the House and Senate and asked them to see what they might want to do with it. Well, they sent it to the FBI, and the FBI said, no match. Well, I don't know what they might have expected, but I stand on that match, and it's held up over time. There's been a lot of dispute. Anything that you do with the assassination is going to be disputed, but no one's knocked off Nathan. I mean, from what he did. So that's how we found it anyway. What we've done with it and how it's stood up over time.
Well, you and others claim this fingerprint match of the real sinister character, Malcolm Mack Wallace, was not only a match, but a super match. And it was like a 14, and I'm told that in fingerprint parlance, that's one that's almost a lock-solid cinch.
That's right. That was the standard the FBI used. They've since changed that. The FBI has changed their rules on prints over the years. But 4 is the minimum now. But like you say, with 14, we've got a solid match. And the beauty of it to me was I could listen to him, and he could explain it to me, and I could see the matches. And how once you've seen it, it fits. I mean, it just like, you know, it's like a light bulb goes off. Oh, yeah, there it is. So I was satisfied, and to me, it was good.
All right.
And like you say, a solid match.
Let's assume that Malcolm Mack Wallace was on the sixth floor of the school book depository at some point and left his fingerprint there. Does that mean he was shooting at John Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963?
No, and any print examiner will tell you that all I can tell you is that this print that was taken from here matches to this fella. That's where you need Loy Factor in there. And then, of course, you need Mack Wallace's history, how he was involved in, like, say, at least 2 other crimes that have been pretty well established involving, well, not just crimes, murders, involving Johnson interests.
Well, let's go there. Well, what are the murders you know that he was involved in?
Well, there was one in 1951 in Austin where a fellow named Doug Kinzer was shot in cold blood by Mack Wallace. He was convicted on it. Well, where I'm getting my information to, and this is important, is from a Texas Ranger who was later a U.S. Marshal named Clint Peoples. And he was there, and everybody had thought that the first murder was over a romantic interlude. He said that wasn't it. It was because Lyndon Johnson's sister was involved, and he at the time, Lyndon Johnson, could not have any kind of a scandal going on. The second one was in June of 1961 when a government auditor was tracking down Billy Saul Estes at the time, and Wallace was there. They were trying to convince this guy,
Henry Marshall.
Henry Marshall, to quit. They'd give him a nice job in Washington and everything. And the grand jury looked at it. Well, first of all, the sheriff looked at it. He said, nah, suicide. Henry Marshall had been shot 5 times in the stomach with a bolt-action rifle. And, you know, three of them were fatal. So two times, two of the shots were after he was dead. And Bolton, you know, you have to bolt. He shot, and it was all kinds of trouble to do that. He'd had carbon monoxide, and he'd been socked up against the side of the face with a blow that was debilitating. This went back to the grand jury in 1984 with Clint Peoples again taking the lead on it. It was his case from the beginning, and he followed through on it. And the grand jury, after considering everything, said that there were three people who were responsible for the murder. They're all dead, so we can't indict them. But the three were Lyndon Johnson, Cliff Carter, and Mack Wallace. We also have Billy Saul Estes, and a lot of people say, well, Billy Saul, he was a convicted fraud and everything else. I don't know if he's up there with your Governor Edwards, but he was quite a fella. Anyway, everything that went to the grand jury didn't rely on Billy Saul Estes at all, but they did have the statements from this Clint Peoples, the Texas Ranger and U.S. Marshal, who was one of the most respected lawmen around. And their decision, I mentioned it. They found Lyndon Johnson was involved.
All right. Well, in the first murder you mentioned, the one of this guy Kinzer on a golf course, Wallace was actually convicted of murder, wasn't he?
Well, he was. And it was cold-blooded murder. And as Clint Peoples said, he never heard of a guy getting off with a 5-year suspended sentence for cold-blooded murder. But that was the ruling that the judge passed down on Wallace, and he walked. I mean, he never spent a day in jail for this, no question about it, cold-blooded murder.
And then Wallace, after committing, as you say, two murders that are directly tied to him, most likely, well, one of them we know, and one is highly suspected, and some other murders that he is connected to by those who claim, he ends up dying mysteriously. What happened to him?
Well, he was killed in a one-car auto accident near Pittsburgh, Texas, in 1971. There's a lot of controversy about the death. It doesn't look like the body, the autopsy and all, like it was, you know, it was a car wreck. It looks like he was beat up and everything else. And some people say he's still around. So we've got this evidence out there that needs further development. And part of the part of what I'm doing now is trying to get that done. In other words, filing a complaint with the law enforcement and say, look into these cases that are still unanswered. In the long run, we got to bring justice for John Kennedy. And, you know, it comes down to that, really.
297-5633 is your number. And we're listening to a man who's making some provocative statements, Barr McClellan, a lawyer who claims that Lyndon Johnson was on the periphery of the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. Now, Barr McClellan, I'm sure some people might be hearing your voice and saying, here's another nut. You're a substantial man. You're a guy who was a lawyer. Your son was the press secretary to the president. I think you were married to the mayor of Austin at one point. You're a fellow who has a background that is impressive. Some would say, even if what you're saying is true or you think it's true, at your stage in life, why in the world are you fighting this battle?
Well, I think it's because, and what I'm doing right now, Jim, is completing a sequel to the first book. And writing it myself, I had such admiration for John Kennedy and feel he's not been treated right that it's something that you can't put down. You've got to, you know, carry it through. And I thought I'd done that with the first book, but a lot of people took issue with me. And since then, though, so many people have come forward with answers, and that's why the sequel is necessary, too, to try and bring as much as possible to a wrap on the case. That may never happen, but we're sure working on it. And I think the biggest, the major support I got after my book came out, first one, was from the Kennedy family. One of them called, and he emailed and said, you know, everything in the book is accurate. And then I had a lady who was a girlfriend to John Jr., and she brought me some really convincing material about how the Kennedy family knew there was a conspiracy.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with Barr McClellan. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We're on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the 35th American president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Our guest, lawyer Barr McClellan, is pointing a finger at the 36th American president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Tomorrow on this show, Richard Lipsey, a Baton Rouge businessman, well-known in this community, who was a soldier and was at the autopsy. He was in the room when President Kennedy was examined in Washington, D.C. He will be with us, as will Vincent Bugliosi, the author of Reclaiming History, who claims fervently in his mind, did so in a huge book, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Is that a possibility? Is that a possibility?
Yes, I really don't see how it could have been with the evidence we have. It's just a good, solid case. And based on all the surrounding circumstances, it points right at and puts it in Johnson's lap. So to go from Oswald being there, yes, he was. I think he did give the correct answer. About the only thing we really heard from him was he was a patsy. And, of course, he was shot down by a mafia guy, and that's pretty well confirmed. In fact, I got a phone call from a guy saying that a real good fella whose credentials I could confirm through a fella in New Orleans, as a matter of fact. So it was a mafia cover-up.
You're saying the mafia was involved and Lyndon Baines Johnson was involved? Both of them?
We know there were two people, but Johnson was taking the lead in the whole matter. The mafia, the guy that called me, and like I say, I confirmed in New Orleans, said we didn't have anything to do with the assassination. We did probably take care of Ruby. Well, okay, so you did. So Oswald, a lot of good friends of mine, very credible guys, don't put Oswald there at all. Where I leave it with is what he said. I'm a patsy. Okay. So you were there and they got the wrong guy, but they got you anyway.
All right. Well, this guy, Malcolm Mack Wallace, let's assume that he was the guy in the sixth floor. There was a lone gunman. It wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. It might have been this guy. I guess that's not beyond the realm of possibility, although people were probably shaking their heads saying, no way. Couldn't happen. Was this guy a skilled marksman?
Who, Mack Wallace?
Yeah.
Well, he was in the Marines in 1940-41, hurt himself on an aircraft carrier when he fell down some stairs. So he had all the training. And we know he was good with the pistol because of the Kinzer murder, which no question about it. And because of the Marshall murder, no question about that. I mean, the grand juries looked at it. They had what they needed. And like I say, we've got law enforcement, a real powerful guy behind it. So Wallace was there. Now, Lloyd Factor was there and said he was there, and he put Oswald there. But so that you have the two men there. Oswald is well identified. There are a lot of questions about it, but someone was there, a second Oswald or someone. So it wasn't just Wallace alone on the sixth floor. Either we've got Lloyd Factor saying I was there, and we've got Oswald, who's been identified from several different directions, including fingerprints.
297-5633 HB in Denham Springs.
Good morning. If memory serves me correct, Mr. Jim has interviewed Jesse Ventura a number of times on this subject. And Mr. Ventura says that there is no way the best firearm expert in the world could not fire the weapon that Lee Harvey Oswald fired that number of times in that short a period of time by the film clips and the frames. What is your opinion, sir, connected with Mr. Ventura? Are you all similar, or are you different in a number of different ways? Thank you.
I was on Jesse's show when he was in Minneapolis with his late show, and the guy is really solid citizen, a real solid citizen. We had a good interview. I think it really got him looking deeper into the subject, and he's since come out with a book. Now, what he says, too, is there was no way one person could have pulled off, the three shots or the four shots, and there's a question about that. The timing, Warren Commission could not prove it. Somehow they did. I take that back. They may have been able to show you could get off two shots, but you couldn't aim them. And that is where you rule out a single shooter. There's no way it could have been just one man shooting. So, conspiracy. You've got two men in there, and I have had that confirmed as far as getting off those shots with some real reliable people, too. So you end up, you walk away from, you look at the crime scene, and there's no way it could have been just one person. It follows that there was a conspiracy.
We're going to go to the phone lines again, and we'll take one more, Kevin, and then we'll pause for a bit, and I'll have a few more questions that I'll relay from online inquiries to Mr. Barr McClellan. This is Larry in Park Forest. Larry, good morning. Larry, you're on the air with Barr McClellan.
Good morning, gentlemen. Look, I want you to tell me this. What is the relation with Jack Ruby? And do you think that Lyndon Baines Johnson was in too big a hurry to become president, that he had to do it on the airplane?
I'm sorry, I didn't get all
okay.
the last part
he,
of your
has,
question.
He asked about Johnson taking the oath of office. I think it was 99 minutes after Kennedy was killed. He seemed to be in a hurry to become president. In fact, I think Bobby Kennedy wanted him to wait until he came back to Washington. But at any rate, that brings us to some other questions. Before we get to LBJ, what about Ruby? Why in the world was he in the police station ready to shoot Oswald and kill him two days after the president was assassinated?
Well, like I say, the evidence that I'm real solid with was he was sent there by the mafia, some of their organization. And he had good connections with the police and could be in there waiting. And there's no question it was a planned assassination. And the way I look at it, it was almost like a standard mafia job, the way he was shot. And to make sure he was dead.
All right. Well,
yes, Mafia did it.
All right. Well,
did that.
LBJ, some of us have great admiration for what he did as president, independent of Vietnam, which was a disaster. But he did some great things. He showed some courage. He was a man of the South who got civil rights legislation passed and enacted and signed. Could this man and have been capable of something like this?
I think what happened, Jim, was once he became president, he really changed. Up until the day he became president, and it happens automatically, incidentally, under the Constitution. There's never a vacancy, and he did rush to get the oath taken. But he was tied in with this Ed Clark, who kept a picture of a painting of a lynching in his office. For many years, Johnson would not honor anything the NAACP requested on making lynching a federal crime. So he was, until he became president, able to move forward. He didn't move forward. He was not an advocate for African Americans. And what he signed...
Before he became president, you're saying he wasn't, but he refused to sign the manifesto that the Southern manifesto that other Southern senators did sign, including the two from Louisiana.
Yeah, he was very good at that. It reminds me of the story. Some of my friends are for it. Some of my friends are against it. I stand with my friends. He could work it both ways. That's what they call the Texas sidestep, as a matter of fact. But he never took an advocate's position regarding African-American rights, and lynching is the best example. It's well documented. And I want to say about civil rights, too. Kennedy was the one pushing that. It was his plan to get that done, and he was having a lot of trouble. How much Johnson could have helped him then is a question, but Bobby Kennedy gave Johnson a hard time publicly because he wouldn't become an advocate, even, you know, while he was vice president. So you have this record he's got. Well, he signed the Civil Rights Act. Well, it really was John Kennedy's bill.
Well, what motivation did he have other than to become president? And it would seem that a lot of people want to be president, but they're not going to shoot somebody to get it. What other motivation was there for LBJ to go to the lengths that you say he went to?
Well, he had one real serious problem, and that was that grand jury, or that murder of Henry Marshall, that had been put on hold but was ready to spring out at any moment. He also had a couple of investigations going on the day of the assassination in Washington. They were dropped as soon as he became president. But his biggest thing was he could get into the White House. It was right there. He was either, you know, as it turned out, two bullets away, and he wanted it. He wanted it so bad he would do anything. And I've tried in my book to go into the history of Texas, how lynching was okay, human life did not have the value it did. And you got a guy here, Lyndon Johnson, who lived and grew up in that era. Very few people are aware of that. And it goes back even, you know, in the turn of the century, turn of the last century, when Johnson was growing up and in his growing up years. And he was determined to get it. It was either for him the White House, which was right there, or the jailhouse, which he really feared. And what was nagging him was all the talk was going around in Washington that he was going to be dropped. And he knew he couldn't be dropped because he had the immunity of the office of the vice president. There's some question about whether he had the immunity, but he thought he was safe.
All right.
Okay. And that didn't happen.
Question from Howard. Are you violating attorney-client privilege by talking about these things regarding Lyndon Johnson, who was a client of your law firm?
Well, that is something that really bothered me. And until I got into a good Fist City fight down at the courthouse in Austin with Ed Clark, they foreclosed on me, and I had to fight back. And in the course of it, they did the manipulating of the judicial system like they could do. I said, why honor, you know, an attorney-client privilege when they don't honor anything? And it just became time for my own rights to take action, and I did.
Well, is this some kind of vindictive retaliation by you?
No, and I can say that real easily because, first of all, it came out because I was in a fight with him. In fact, in 1984, I first said what I mentioned earlier, that Clark arranged the assassination. So it was out then back in 84. It was my survival at the time. I guess, you know, you could call it a shootout or whatever, but it was one or the other of us. And I survived. The bank he used folded. This all, you know, occurred over a number of years. And it became more than that, just my admiration for John Kennedy and what he stood for. I think in his inauguration, he said, go ahead.
Go ahead. What did he say?
He said, ask, you know, service for your country, not what your country can do for you. And Kennedy epitomized that. He was a symbol of serving your country. I mean, he served it from the Pacific Ocean, you know, the Pacific War all the way to the end of his life. Johnson was the exact opposite. I mean, you know, hey, I want to take all I can. He got a commission on about anything he did.
Well, why didn't you leave earlier? You had many chances to leave that law firm, and you say your boss, you knew he was involved in this crime. Why didn't you say, I've had enough, I'm out of here, before it became a public fight?
Well, I should have. But at first, I just really didn't believe it. When my law partner told me, you know, the first inkling I even had of what had happened. But as it got deeper and deeper, it became impossible. And I did leave the firm when Clark wanted me to represent this company that I could not represent. And they were really bad.
Chris in Prairieville. I'm sorry, we were short on time. I want to slide in a few more people who've been waiting patiently. Chris in Prairieville, you're on with Barr McClellan.
Great. Great program. I really appreciate you coming on. I had a quick question about motivations. President Kennedy gave a speech shortly before his assassination regarding secret societies and coming out against, you know, secrets in places of power and government. And I've always suspected that if maybe there was some motivation there, that there was fear that he was going to sort of turn the lights on some of the dirty practices that were going on. And do you know anything about that?
Yes, and John Kennedy gave a really moving speech on the subject that we can't have this, we can't have secrecy. And he was doing the best he could to open it up. As far as the depth of that went, the best I can tell you is that Clark was a member of a special secret society in Texas. And these secret societies, you really don't have to be a member. You just have to know the right people. And, of course, Clark knew those right people. But, yes, there was a, as Jackie said, a group. And she brought it out in a book that people don't know much about. But it said that this Cabal, C-A-B-A-L, was involved.
All right.
So, yes, we're pointing there, but right now I can't tell you who, as far as a group or individuals, but I can sure tell you the picture anyway.
George Becker asks about Jim Garrison. What did you think of his investigation?
It was probably the most important one to get everything started. When my book came out, I was at a book signing in New Orleans, and they were there, and I told them, you know, that it was really unfortunate what had happened to Jim's investigation, but that he got it started because, of course, he leads to Oliver Stone coming out with JFK. And, in fact, my book's been bought by friends of Oliver Stone, so
right. The
movie's coming
and,
out here.
And another one's coming soon, Verdict, and we will hopefully have a chance to talk with Barr at that time, if not sooner. But another question... listener says he saw the History Channel documentary, and you referred to Johnson's psychiatric records. What would those records show if they were released?
Well, I wish I knew, but I know he went into deep therapy after he left the White House. He was very depressed, and it was life-threatening. And they had this psychiatrist they used, and I know where his offices were, but I do not have any records, and yet I know where those records, if we ever going to find them, where they are, and we should go get them.
You think they would shed light on the allegations you've made, the explosive allegations you've made today and in the past?
I'm sure they would, Jim. It's that kind of thing. The records are there. We need to get them.
Well, Oliver Barr McClellan, entrepreneur, counsel, and author, now living in Gulfport, Mississippi. His book in 2003, Blood, Money, and Power, was certainly controversial, and the book by Roger Stone is certainly a follow-up to Barr McClellan's work. He'll be back soon with Verdict, and we thank you for joining us today, Barr McClellan.
Jim, a real pleasure.
And
thank
congratulations
you.
On your family. Not only Scott, but other McClellans have done very well. Scott was the son you were talking about. You were with on the day Kennedy was assassinated.
No, he was the last one. The first one was Mark. He's the doctor who's next.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by actor Michael O'Neill. He'll soon be seen as Richard Barkley in the highly anticipated feature film Dallas Buyers Club. Good morning, Michael O'Neill.
Good morning, Jim. Nice to be with you.
It was nice to talk to you again, this man who's a graduate of Auburn University. It's been a good year for the War Eagles.
Wow, has it not? I actually was able to get to the game on Saturday, and I've seen a lot of football in my life, but nothing like that.
My goodness. Auburn... only one loss, and that to LSU this year, and the War Eagles are doing spectacularly well under Gus Malzahn in his first season as head coach. And you speak as a guy who knows football and a little bit about Auburn football.
Well, I was fortunate enough to go to school there, and I'm very, you know, both proud of them and happy for them. Jim, nobody saw this coming. No one really expected it. And of course, you know, LSU at LSU, is there's not a tougher place to play. I have great respect for that program. And, you know, I hail from Louisiana. My father was born on Arabella Street in New Orleans. So I follow both those Tigers pretty closely.
Well, you began your acting career under the mentorship of a fabulous actor named Will Gear. How did that happen?
you know, Jim, it was just a blind stroke of luck. I had written something, an address that Will heard on tape for my national fraternity, which he had been a member of 50 years earlier at the University of Chicago. And he called me. He said, you know, how to get in touch with this fellow. And he called me. I was a senior at Auburn. I was finishing. I'd finished my last college exam. And he called and said, son, I think you should try acting before the corporate structure snaps you up. I said, Mr. Gere, I don't know anything about it. And he was kind enough to let me come to California. And he and his daughter, Ellen, really trained me. They, you know, I could barely read in terms of reading aloud or interpreting something. And they were gracious enough and generous enough to sort of plant a seed. And, you know, we moved forward from there.
Well, that's not a bad start with Will Gere. No wonder you've done well, and you've had a long career. Dallas Buyers Club is what I mentioned going in. This is quite a production, quite a cast.
It's a marvelous cast, Jim, and, you know, it's sort of the little engine that could, in a way. This film had about three incarnations, and the money kept going away. And this last cast with Matthew and Jared Leto and Jennifer Garner, it's a remarkable ensemble and some of the bravest performances I've ever been around. And I've been around some pretty good ones. And I have to give tremendous credit to Robbie Brenner and Rachel Winter. They just wouldn't let it not happen. And, you know, I don't think they get enough credit for the fact that this little film is here because of them. And Matthew's performance, I've rarely seen anything like it. You know, I remember once working with
him.
When
you say Matthew, we're talking about Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
There are some actors who might not have taken this role.
No. You know, it was Brad Pitt at one point had signed on and Ryan Gosling had signed on, but it was Matthew that brought it to fruition. And it's interesting, Jim, because, again, the money went away and Matthew started losing weight. And he said, I'm doing the film. And his agents in California basically went, oh, my God, we've got to get this. We've got to get this together because we're about to lose our actor. You know, he's literally going into a physicalness that it can't be used anywhere else. And so Matthew gets a tremendous amount of credit for it happening. It certainly wouldn't have happened without his commitment to it. And it's a stunning performance, just stunning.
Well, tell us about the character that Matthew plays in Dallas Buyers Club.
Jim, it's based on a true character, a man named Ron Woodruff, who was a, you know, sometimes bull rider, electrician, what we'd call in the old days a rounder. He was just a, you know, he was a hellraiser. And he contracted the disease and was given 30 days to live. And he said, there's nothing on the planet that can kill me in 30 days. And went about trying to find a way of treating himself outside of the, you know, the quote-unquote medical establishment or the paradigm that they were allowing at that time, the treatment. And I end up playing the FDA agent who tries to meet him and block him at every turn because he's got to go far afield. He's in Mexico and Israel and Japan and South America, you know, finding whatever he can find, really. And it's, you know, this he lost. He was down to about 130 pounds, I think. So, honestly, I was 15 feet from Matthew, and I didn't recognize him my first day on the set. I looked right by him. And it's one of those commitments and a performance that is one for the ages, I think. And I don't make predictions much, but if he's not nominated, I'd be surprised.
People forget how good an actor he is.
Well, yes, and I think he's reminding them. You know, there's always been a talent there, but there's a maturation and a care for his talent. You see something in this that rarely do American actors have an opportunity to do. There's a freedom in this performance that takes a lot of experience and a tremendous amount of guts. And he didn't leave anything in the bag, as we like to say.
And we're visiting with another fine actor, Michael O'Neill, and you say you play an adversary in the film.
Yeah, well, his primary adversary is the disease, but his human adversary is me. And, you know, I'm working with a man who's desperate and determined. And on the one hand, you feel some compassion about his condition. On the other hand, I have a job to do. You know, I'm hired to protect the people, as it were, and this is one of those things that falls into that category. So I try to block him at each and every turn, and it creates an interesting tension between the two of us. So,
I would think so. And two guys who can show tension on the screen like few others. But this film, Dallas Buyers Club, it involves transsexuals, certainly a discussion about AIDS, homosexuality. It's something that even in 2013, some people may think, wow, how does this make it to the big screen?
Well, it is brave, and certainly people have shied away from it time and time again. And I tip my cap to Matthew McConaughey for doing what he did and bringing the story about. And it's true. It's about all those things. I mean, they're all elements in it, Jim. And yet in the simple storytelling way, it's a story of a hero's journey, an unlikely hero. I mean, he's just not a character that you could see this coming with a telescope. And he refuses. He's just relentless in his pursuit of something to help himself and then, by extension, other people. And I have to say, he's probably, you know, one of the guys that came up with the cocktail approach to treating that disease. And we're talking about an early, early, early manifestation. I mean, I was in New York City when AIDS came about, and it was so early, Jim. We didn't know what was causing it. We didn't know if it was airborne. We didn't know anything. We just knew that people around us in the theater community and at large were getting desperately ill. And he's desperately ill, and he's, you know, desperately going about trying to find a way to deal with it.
Michael O'Neill's been a busy actor. He's been in many fine films, including Seabiscuit and J. Edgar. Transformers is another one, Traffic, the Steven Soderbergh film. How was it working with him?
You know, marvelous. He's so clean and simple in what he does. You know, he works his own camera, Jim, so he's virtually editing inside the camera. But the thing that I remembered about him most of all was he was so specific and so gentle in bringing about performance. I had an idea about something, and he sort of saved me from my own intentions, as it were. He enjoys watching actors do what they do. I remember him doing takes when I visited him on set of the first Ocean's 11 film, and he was filming something that Don Cheadle was doing over and over and over again. And he looked at me and he says, "I just like to see what he'll do next." You know, and so it's nice to have a director that appreciates that.
You were in J. Edgar, as I stated. Now, did that film change your opinion at all about J. Edgar Hoover?
You know what it did do? It made me realize how brilliant he was at what he did. I mean, he saw the world in organization. He saw the world in catalog. And it was both his incredible talent and asset, and probably in a way his fatal flaw, which is the beauty of any character that when they exist in tension or tandem like that. No one had cataloged evidence the way he did or actually seen the world quite that way until J. Edgar did it. And so it did change my opinion of him and the complexity of who he was.
Thank you, Michael O'Neill. Fine actor, will be in Dallas Buyers Club, coming soon to theaters in this area. And now we're joined in studio by Molly Bookman, the mastermind of the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater. Good morning and happy birthday, Eve.
Good morning. Thank you. Only one of the masterminds. We have to give as much credit to Sharon Matthews.
She's been with you
from the beginning.
From the start, from day one, which was
a
long time ago, just 37 years ago. We had Smiley Anders yesterday, and he's been writing his column for 34 years. You've been doing this for 37 years.
Well, doing Baton Rouge Ballet Theater, yes.
Right. How many years for the Nutcracker?
Well, the first Nutcracker, A Tale from the Bayou, was 1991.
So now we're 22. Well, it'd actually be the 23rd
23.
Presentation.
Okay. All right.
And a month from today.
December 21st and 22nd, better than ever. You know, Baton Rouge loves this production. We never expected it would go this long, but we we have to keep doing it. Baton Rouge loves it, and it gets bigger and grander every year.
Bigger and grander. Why is this one bigger and grander than the last one, which was pretty good?
Well, we have the last one was great, but we have fabulous guest artists. This year, for the first time, our Sugar Plum Fairy is Erica Carneo. She is the principal dancer with the Boston Ballet. And her husband, Carlos, who has been with us before. So we will have a married couple again. And we're also bringing in two other guest stars who are former members of our company. Meredith Broussard will be here as the Azalea Fairy, and LeBrian Patrick will be back as the Nutcracker and the Arabian. So it's going to be better than ever.
Well, Kevin Gallagher says this is so popular. The Nutcracker has gotten to be such a huge component of our holiday season that people are scalping tickets. Is that right?
Well, if you go online, the first thing that comes up is one of these ticket brokers who has the tickets priced from $80 to $285. And we actually hear people buying them. And we would like people to know that tickets for the Nutcracker start at $20 and go up to $45. We keep them reasonably priced so our community can participate every year so that large families can come. You can get these tickets by calling the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater at 766-8379. That's 225-766-8379. You can also go to Ticketmaster. Now, Ticketmaster does add a service charge to the ticket, and it's a little bit more, a bigger service charge than the ballet does, but nothing like $80 to $285. Come get your tickets from our organization or go to Ticketmaster.
766-8379. That's 225-766-8379. The 23rd presentation of the Nutcracker, the 22nd and the 21st.
The 21st and 22nd. And don't forget the Baton Rouge Symphony accompanies the Nutcracker. So it is a huge production.
It is, and it's something I know you work on all year long, although the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater has presentations all year. In fact, you just had a major one a few weeks ago.
Ailey 2 was a huge smash. If you missed it, you missed a great show. Don't let that happen for Nutcracker. And by the way, you can right now still get VIP seats to the Nutcracker if you buy our mini season ticket, which includes a ticket to Nutcracker and a ticket to Snow White, which plays April 5th and 6th, okay. And that's $100.
Okay.
Those are great seats.
No telling what those will be going for from the scalpers. Scalpers for the Nutcracker.
You know, we're proud, but we don't want people to be spending extra money, and we don't want other people making all this money off of them.
You effused enthusiasm. After all these years, it's still fun for you. It seems to be.
It's great fun for me now, and especially so that I've retired from LSU. And because we have, you know, watching these young dancers in our community grow up and become beautiful dancers and beautiful people, whether they go on to dance professionally or not, is a great joy.
Well, we thank you for coming this time every year, Molly, and usually on your birthday. And tomorrow will be your birthday. And
yes,
you were celebrating a birthday on November 22nd, 1963, when the world changed.
That's a Jeopardy question I can always answer, is when was Kennedy shot? Probably most people can.
What school were you attending?
Baton Rouge Junior High, ninth grade, Miss St. Dizier's social studies class, when we found out.
And you said some people were...
We heard people in the halls actually cheering. And the main reason I remember that is because a teacher came into the room and sort of commiserated with Miss St. Dizier. Miss St. Dizier said, "Look at this class. They're reacting differently." And I remember that teacher looking at us and being grateful that not everyone was happy.
People were cheering the assassination.
Well, they were kids. They were kids with a different political
system. Now, why would they have that opinion?
Because their parents did.
And why did their parents have that opinion?
Kennedy
carried Louisiana.
Yes, but there was a certain element of the public that was, did they call them the Dixiecrats? Were they opposed to desegregation? And there was a certain element that was, you know, it's not as divisive as it is right now. It was not as evenly divided, and as there was not as much animosity, but it was still there. It was just a smaller group.
Well, it's hard to believe that anybody would cheer the assassination of a president, even one that they don't like. After all, that's an assault on the system that we treasure and behold.
And yet people do it now. They cheer belittling our president, whoever he
well,
is. And that's
hope,
an assault. That's an assault on America.
Whether it's President Bush or President Clinton or the current president, nobody would cheer if the president got shot and, heaven forbid, got assassinated.
But they want to do everything they can to bring him down. Well, hopefully not to that extent.
Well, tomorrow we will talk with Richard Lipsey, who served President Kennedy, knew him as a young soldier, and he was there when the president's body was brought back to Washington for an autopsy. He believes that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman, as does Vincent Bugliosi, who will also be with us to talk about his belief that people who were saying that there was a conspiracy are way off base. We'll talk again tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher and Molly Bookman, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.